Welcome, everyone. We're going to go a little out of order today to accommodate a couple of tight schedules. So we will start off our hearing today with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 578. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 578 comes to you from Senator Brown, Verger, and quite a few others. Creates a crime of trafficking in persons in the first and second degree and sets a penalty as a Class A felony and a Class B felony, respectively. Defines trafficking as a crime if a person recruits, provides, obtains, harbors, or transports another person, knowing that force, fraud, or coercion will be used to cause the other person to provide labor or services, or two, knowingly receives anything of value for participation, ventures, and engage recruiting, and several other issues. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Here's a set of amendments that will be coming to this bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would incorporate Senate Bill 578 with 243, taking the best of both bills and melding them together.
Perfect. Who would like to go first?
You go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you very much for scheduling this committee hearing. We received the notice on relatively short notice, so we have a bunch of certified smart people sitting behind us, so we're just going to give you sort of a broad overview and let them fill in the nitty-gritty details. I think the biggest question is, why do we need this particular law? And what I would say to you is that we have 24 other states that have laws specifically on human trafficking. Our other states, Washington to the north of us and California to the south of us, both have legislation on this issue. I'm sorry, I forgot to identify myself. Kate Brown represents Senate District 21, a little bit of northeast Portland, a lot of bit of southeast Portland, and the city of Milwaukee. So, anyway, basically this bill would do three things. It would raise awareness amongst law enforcement. It would provide for a commitment level, and it would provide law enforcement actual tools for law enforcement, and it shows a commitment from the legislature to deal with this issue. It provides much needed assistance to law enforcement service providers and the public in combating human trafficking. The U.S. State Department estimates that between 17,000 and 20,000 people are trafficked into the United States each year. Oregon obviously is not a border state. We're probably what I would consider a pass-through state, but we're sandwiched in between two border states. So you have the potential of folks coming in through Canada, up through Mexico. And the other area that we have folks, the possibility of folks coming in, is through our ports. And I would tell you, and you all have probably delved into this issue, but our ports are not particularly secure and cargo's not checked. So that would be another area where folks would come into this particular state. So we lack any legislation, and I urge this committee to follow the lead of 24 other states in the arena. There is federal legislation on the issue. It is called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2000. It was reauthorized in 2003. So we urge you to pass the bill. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Senator beside me. For the record, my name is Representative Deborah Boone. I represent the Upper Left Coast, House District 32. And this has come before us before through some other representatives earlier in last session, the session before. And I'm glad to see it come forward again. I was first alerted to this issue on an overseas trip, and this is a really big problem in Europe and in Asia. And I see this as a preemptive preventive strike that the U.S. can take, especially Oregon, can add to the 24 states to help this state become free of this problem. If we prevent it, it won't happen here, and I'm happy to support this. I'm not going to go into all the details of the bill because, as Senator Brown has advised you, we have some very smart people behind us who will do that. But this also has been followed internationally, and I've been reading Nicholas Kristof's columns occasionally as he takes us through the problem in the international arena. So I add my voice very strongly. This is a very important bill for our state to take action on, and I hope that you see the same thing. I know there are going to be some more people speaking, more amendments coming, and I hope to talk to you soon again. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Make sure you get off easy.
Well, Senator Breyer, I would just say to the committee, as this committee is aware, we have 83 co-sponsors. I think the reason why we weren't able to get the full 90 is folks were concerned about the fiscal impact. And I would just say to you that simply by having the legislation on the books, that we give law enforcement additional tools to combat these particular crimes. But the other piece is I would anticipate you're not going to see thousands of actual prosecutions. You're probably looking at handfuls of prosecutions on an annual basis, so that the fiscal impact of this bill is minimal, but its use as an education and law enforcement tool is extremely critical. So,
thank you, Senator, for pointing that out, and I think you're right. If there's any big cases, they're likely to be dealt with on a federal level anyway, and so we'd be looking at the smaller cases. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just did that so I could say thank you, Mr. Chair, because it's probably my time. this session. that was for you, Kate. This would also be a crime if it happens within the state and doesn't go outside the borders. So there could be an impact there. But you talked about foreign and crossing state boundaries, but this could very well be happening just inside the state of Oregon as well.
No question. So, thank you very much.
Okay.
We appreciate
thank
your
you
time and energy.
Next up, looks like the three want to come together. Chris Carey, Kathleen Martinez, and Brian, is it Wilkes?
Willis.
Come forward, please. State your names when you begin for the record, and lead off with whichever order you'd wish to go in.
Thank you, Committee Chair and Chairman. My name is Christopher Carey, and I am a professor at Portland State University, and I am also the executive director of a 501c3 nonprofit called the Daywalka Foundation. We are funded by the State Department and other donors to work on this issue internationally, and we currently have offices in India, Nepal, Bangladesh, and recently in Mexico City. I've done a little bit of work working with the Department of Justice and the Oregon Human Trafficking Task Force. I'm kind of advising, and I was part of the work group last summer that helped draft this legislation. So I'm going to be very brief, and I also have just seen the amendments, so I'm just kind of processing this stuff. So after the buildup of being certified smart people, I want to try to live up to that, but I'm not sure I'll be able to. Trafficking in persons, as Senator Brown noted, is a worldwide problem. It's also a problem in the United States, with trafficking networks been documented in every state of the union. We know it is happening in Oregon, but we've just recently begun kind of a unified effort to kind of take a look at what is happening here and the differences. The Human Trafficking Task Force is part of that, and I think passing this piece of legislation is also incredibly important as well. There are 20,000 people that come across the borders every year that are trafficked, but as Senator Cruz noted, there is a large problem with what we call internal trafficking, because trafficking doesn't have to be across borders. It's just transportation or movement. So the Department of Justice estimates there are 300,000 children that are commercially exploited every year in this country. Those are trafficking cases if they're transported and if there's a third person. Brian Willis today, my right, I think can speak to some of this in Oregon and why kind of this is an area that needs exploration that the bill addresses. Internationally, Portland is known as a secondary city, so many times people will get trafficked into the United States to border areas and then shipped off other places. But Seattle is primary city. Portland, we end up as called secondary markets. There have been cases documented here ranging from commercial sexual exploitation of Vietnamese to last year's headlines in the Willamette Weekly, which featured the case of the Honduran youth that had been brought up, came across the United States, his debt was sold, and then instead of engaging in other work, he was made to sell drugs on the East Side Max tracks. Deputy Martinez, who is the head of the Oregon Human Trafficking Task Force, can talk about some of those other cases. But in short, I think this is very needed both to kind of focus law enforcement and also as a tool, because there are some crimes that may go unpunished. Somebody that's tangentially involved in the recruitment or selling of a debt, we may not have a crime to cover that. And what this does, it makes really clear that the state has a commitment, that law enforcement has a commitment, and that the people of the state of Oregon have a commitment. I have some specific kind of suggestions for the bill, but I think that's probably better done by written testimony, unless you have questions.
No, I think you're right. And if you have an amendment for the bill, you're ahead of us, because we don't have a written amendment for a bill yet.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, maybe I can give some background to him. Mr. Carey, among others, and myself were involved in a work group over the interim after last session, and the product of that, Senate Bill 243. The bills are slightly different. This bill has a broader relating clause and also contains the right for civil action. We have an amendment coming that would combine 243 with this bill. And at some point, if you like, when that amendment gets here, and we've sent it down the Legislative Council's office. As you know, they just got through a bill drafting deadline. They're now doing amendments. I anticipate it being back in several days.
I anticipate when the amendment gets back, we'll have a chance to look it over, and another chance. I'm sure the work group will have another chance to look it over, too. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe a question for Mr. Taylor, because 243 is involuntary servitude, which would seem to be a broader scope than just if trafficking means you're moving people, involuntary servitude would mean you could leave them in place and still be doing similar things. Am I reading that right? Or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Cruz, there was a slightly different approach taken on the draft. Okay. We started off with a draft that came from the United States Department of Justice. It was a broad draft. It overlapped with a lot of current law. And through the interim, we narrowed it. There were some issues, disagreements in the work group over the penalties involved. And as we worked through it, we came up with involuntary servitude and human trafficking. One, you have the second if you have the first. It's just a different approach. We also included it in RICO, which is not in this bill. This bill does have a right of civil action. In the other bill, you have a right of restitution under our restitution statute. In 578, you have a provision that says the person who's trafficked has a defense to any criminal activity that they were involved in. That's not in 243.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, who's next? My name is Brian Willis. I'm the health advisor to EPPAT USA. We are the U.S. chapter of an international organization based in Bangkok. EPPAT International has chapters in approximately 55 countries. It's one of the first organizations to combat the prostitution of children and what's referred to as sex tourism, beginning in the early 90s. EPPAT USA focuses on combating commercial sexual exploitation of children, including child prostitution, child pornography, and trafficking of children. I'm also an advisor to Catholic Charities of Oregon that has a group working on addressing trafficking of foreign-born persons into Oregon or around Oregon. I'm also an advisor to Catholic Charities USA, the national headquarters of Catholic Charities, that has a workforce addressing domestic trafficking of children. Some of the comments that have been brought up about trafficking is, you know, we do realize it's a global issue, but it is very much an issue within the United States. And as Chris mentioned, there's an estimated 200,000 to 300,000 children in this country who are victims of sexual exploitation through prostitution. By that, I want to be clear, those are American children. So the estimate is that approximately 20,000 people are trafficked into the United States per year. But there are at least 200,000 American children who are victims of sexual exploitation. That is a form of trafficking. Just for background, I started working on this issue, and I focus on the health impact of sex trafficking. I started working on this in 1990 when I was working for the federal government. My experience here in Portland dates back to 1999. I came back from a project in Pakistan and found that two women and a teenage girl in Portland had been murdered. They were all involved in prostitution and dumped up in Forest Park. I've been working with a number of organizations, including Multnomah County Sheriff's Department, to discuss what we can do in Portland and around the metro area to address this issue.
As with Chris, I have a number of suggestions for the legislation. A couple that I'd like to specifically mention is that I would hope that the legislation, the bill, is very clear that this includes American victims, what we refer to as domestic trafficking, and is not only contemplated to address trafficking of foreign-born individuals who may be trafficked in or through Oregon. Also, I hope it's... you will also seriously consider increasing the age of child victims under this bill. Currently, for a Class B felony, is only contemplated if the victim is 11 years old or under. EPCAT USA would strongly encourage you to increase that to include all children. So that means anyone who is a child, anyone under 18 years of age. Finally, in addition, one of the conditions for the crime of trafficking is the use of force. We'd also encourage you to consider adding a phrase, threat of force, because oftentimes traffickers will threaten somebody, they never actually harm them, but it's the threat of force that coerces them into trafficking. In addition, one of the requirements is for a person to be charged is that they know that force, fraud, or coercion will be used. I think that that perhaps may be a heavy burden on prosecutors to prove the trafficker's state of mind. So I hope you will consider revisiting that issue. Finally, I'd also recommend that we look at the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act that I think will give us some guidance on the state law. And I think it would be very helpful if the state law was consistent with the federal law. There was one other thing I was going to mention, and that is while this penalizes traffickers, I think we also need to work very hard to make sure that there are enforcement and penalties of the people who take advantage of trafficking victims, what may be referred to as the clients or sometimes Johns. These are good penalties for the traffickers, but oftentimes we hear trafficking described as a supply and demand issue. It is those people on the street that are creating the demand, and these people, the traffickers, are supplying the victims. So while we need to go after those traffickers who supply the victims, we must also be sure that we go after the people who are exploiting the victims. And lastly, these victims have an extremely wide range of health problems. It is very important that we not only punish those who abuse these victims, but I think it is extremely important that we ensure that all victims have access to the type of health care and mental health services that they need as part of their recovery process from being trafficked.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Walker.
Your points are all well taken, but especially the one about the children. I'm not sure why it's been cut off at the age of 12. Does anyone on that panel know?
No, it wasn't in the work group last year, and 18 is actually what we would probably look to and recommend. It's what other states do, and that's consistent with the Palermo Protocol, which is the international governing instrument. And the reason it's the child is because if it's for the purposes of commercial sexual exploitation, which is just one part of trafficking, you don't need to have to prove the force, fraud, or coercion, because a child can't consent to this anyway.
Right.
Chris also reminded me that the statute actually is not clear whether this also covers sexual exploitation. I refer to the federal law, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, TVPA. They use the term Commercial Sex Act. Currently, as I've read various iterations of the bill, it's still unclear to me whether it covers trafficking for sexual purposes or sexual exploitation, or the term used in TVPA for Commercial Sex Act.
Mr. Willis, were you on the group that helped work on the amendments?
I was not.
Okay, maybe we should make sure we get his thoughts incorporated or at least discussed in that group so we can take a closer look at them. Mr. Taylor?
Sure. Mr. Carey and Mr. Willis, tell me, everything you've described is now a crime. What is deficient in current law, in your opinion?
I've looked at, actually, just yesterday, I was meeting with Kathleen Martinez about this, and we were looking at some of the issues regarding, particularly regarding prostitution of children. I think one of the issues is that currently it doesn't seem as though there are very many prosecutions and convictions for people under current law for compelling, which is forcing a child into prostitution. Under Oregon law, the term used is compelling. So currently, I think that the law on compelling is not enforced as much as what it should be. You know, I think I've seen over time, like when I started working on this, people didn't really talk about trafficking. Chris has mentioned the Paloma Protocol, which came into effect in 2000, and we've sort of had a very large mind change in how we address this issue, going from calling children child prostitutes to now understanding that they are victims of trafficking. So I think this law reflects changes both in how we view the world from a form of exploitation in both a societal perspective but also in a legal perspective. I think this leaps ahead of where we were as far as charging people for child prostitution.
Okay. There might be a couple of other, and I'll, again, so one of the, you know, we don't know what a typical recruitment scenario is, but if it's, it can be via smuggling across the border, and then that person's debt gets sold, either for forced labor or exploitation, or as the Lambert Weekly article pulled out, selling drugs on the east side max tracks. Unless it's a coercion prosecution, which is difficult in some areas, it might be a stretch, it may be difficult to cast the net to be able to get all of those people who are recruiting materially benefiting from this process in some way. And that's one of the very concrete things that the law does. It kind of caps those people that would fall through the net right now.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Martinez?
My name is Kathleen Martinez. I'm a deputy with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I currently work in the capacity of the Oregon Human Trafficking Task Force. Multnomah County submitted for a grant from the DOJ, and we received it in October of 2005. We work with Catholic Charities as our NGO, and we also work with the FBI, ICE, and with the U.S. Attorney's Office to educate those around the state in law enforcement, the community, and other capacities where trafficking victims would meet them, and also to investigate and for convictions on this crime. I've been working in this capacity since August. I've been a deputy for 10 years. I can tell you that I have an uphill battle in training law enforcement on what human trafficking is. Most people in law enforcement, or people that you mentioned human trafficking to, they'll think that you're talking about smuggling. The difference between smuggling and trafficking is that when someone's smuggled into the United States or smuggled anywhere, that's where there's been an agreement. You bring me into the United States for this fee, and that's what they do, and they leave them off. When it becomes trafficking is when they make an agreement, they come into the United States, and then once they're here, the trafficker will say, you know what, now you owe me more debt, and this is how you're going to pay me back. They force them into an involuntary servitude in with whatever they choose, either sex trafficking or any sort of labor, and require them to pay off the debt. So it's basically modern-day slavery. I can testify to that I currently have 5 cases on my desk right now of sex trafficking, and that's only from the Portland area. And that's only from the last 2 months, and they're all underage girls that were trafficked. They were pimped out. They're advertised on Craigslist. It's well known that you can find it on Craigslist under erotic services, casual encounters, men seeking women, women seeking men. I encourage you to look at those sites. And it's all in plain English. It's not difficult. It's not coded on how to get a prostitute in the Portland area.
Madam Chair,
how can they do that on Craigslist for an underage child?
Well, they don't. It doesn't say that they're 13 or 14 or whatever. It'll say 18, or it doesn't give an age at all. In the cases that I have, it will say. Generally, it'll say that they're 18, but I think most people can understand that maybe they're 18 and maybe they're not. I'm not sure what the why they're allowed to advertise on Craigslist. I think because Craigslist is probably a private entity, and they also have a disclaimer at the end that if you're browsing through this and you see anything that is questionable material, you can mark it and let Craigslist know, and they'll take a look at it and take it off. But what we're finding is that with Craigslist, people can just, you know, it's a free service. You don't have to tell them exactly who you are. You just post what you want, and people post several times a day, maybe one service or one whatever they're selling, because it scrolls down, and, you know, you're not at the top of the list anymore. So in an hour or so, you might want to post it again so you're at the top. So that's what we're seeing. We're also seeing that they're communicating through social networks on the Internet, like through MySpace. Those are a little bit harder because they're people are saying who they are or maybe not who they are. But in the cases that I've seen, they're pretty clear about who they are. They're saying that they're a pimp and this is what they're about. And so it's kind of interesting. So did you have any other questions for me?
I guess I have a question, not necessarily for you, but for anyone on the panel. The And I'm assuming that if the work group has thought of this and they're, dealing with it in the bill draft. I haven't gone through it enough to know, but, you know, currently under the H-2A program to bring in federal bring in alien workers legally, to do that, the worker has to sign up to work for a specific employer for a specific length of time, doing a specific duty. They get... have to be provided transportation and housing once they get here. It very much sounds like human trafficking, but it's done through a federal program. So I'm assuming that that's not going to be considered then if an employer goes through an H-2A program to bring workers into the country, that there's going to be exception for that in this legislation.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, I've never seen that issue come up. In fact, not just the H-2A program, but all of the H programs, the non-immigrant visas, foreign employees will come over here. The key to trafficking is this idea of consent, not being behind your will, and exploitation. And so for H-2A programs, you have to file labor certs, you have to do compliances with the Department of Labor. So I've never seen that situation arise here. And if it's something that we want to, like, mentioned specifically in the legislation, that's, you know, that seems fine.
Mr. Taylor. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 243, the amendment that's proposed for this bill, that's clarified, because as a person commits a crime of subjecting another to involuntary servitude in the first degree, if the person knowingly and without lawful authority forces or attempts to force another person to engage in services.
Okay, I think it's important that if employers are using illegal programs and, you know, we just don't throw a net so broadly that they can even be charged, or, you know, as they're talking, you know, they're setting up a labor camp, they're bringing people from another country to work in this camp, they have to work for me, they can't work anywhere else, and it goes off in somebody's mind that, oh my God, they're involved in human trafficking, and we just want to make sure that we're not bringing people into court who are doing it by the book.
Mm-hmm.
So, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one more witness signed up, David Martin.
Anyone else like to testify
on Senate Bill 578? Didn't sign up. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Martin. I'm a policy advisor for Senator Verger. She's sorry that she was unable to attend today, but she's in another committee as well. I'll be very brief because I think you've heard a lot of the kind of issues that this bill helps tackle. What I would say is that Senator Brown's written testimony that she submitted does have the amendments and kind of what it'll look like for Senate Bill 578, and it'll kind of cover some of the issues. It puts in the definition of involuntary servitude, allows for restitution, allows for the RICO prosecution. It also has in that language about the without legal authority, so that would help tackle Senator Byers' concern. And it also, that one thing that hasn't really been mentioned is it does create a short-term task force. We think that this is important because it'll help the state not only study the extent of the problem, but also measure the progress of the state's effort, as well as allowing the state to seek out funding that could provide assistance to the victims of this crime. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, for taking over on this hearing. Is there any questions from the committee before we lose them all together? Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else who wishes to testify? Thank you very much. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 578, and we'll wait for amendments to be forthcoming. And thank you all for who presented this bill for us today. It sounds like a really good piece of work. We will now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 553.
Madam Chairman, as a committee, I'm not the staff person on the bill. I know what it does.
Are you 2360?
I am.
Okay. We'll open a close public hearing on 553. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2360. Council.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2360 comes to you at the request of the Oregon State Bar Elderly Law Section, and it allows a conservator to close out the conservatorship and create a trust for a protected person if the trust was created for the purposes of qualifying the protected person for need-based government benefits or maintain the eligibility of the protected person for need-based government benefits. Set forth the terms and conditions.
Okay, we have signed up Ryan Gibb.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Gibb. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. Primary focus of my practice is elder law. I'm also a member of the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm the chair of the legislative committee of the elder law section. The typical elder law practice deals with a variety of issues, but it includes a lot of public benefits, probates, guardianships, conservatorships, and every now and then those issues collide. One instance when those issues come together is when a person who is receiving certain public benefits such as SSI and or Medicaid receives some kind of a lump sum payment. They may get a back payment from Social Security. They may get a personal injury award. They may have a house and still qualify for the programs, and maybe the house is sold. In those circumstances, the individual is going to lose their public benefits unless they are able to deal with those funds in a way that allows them to stay on the public benefit programs. Some of those public benefit programs allow the individual to put those funds into what's called a payback trust or a D4 trust, referencing the Social Security Act. Those funds are placed into the trust. They are available only for certain types of expenditures, what we call supplemental needs, and then the individual can retain their eligibility for the public benefit program. The federal statute, Social Security Act, requires that these types of trusts be created not by the individual, but rather by a parent or a grandparent or by the court. In a lot of situations, then we end up with the court appointing a conservator for the purpose of creating this trust. ORS 125.440 states that if a trust is created in a conservatorship, the trust purpose cannot be to end or terminate the conservatorship. So the conservatorship essentially stays open even though these funds have been placed into a trust and there's no need technically for the conservatorship to stay open. The elder law section has requested the amendment to ORS 125.440 to allow, in specific circumstances, the conservatorship to be closed if these funds are being directed into a special needs or supplemental needs trust for the individual. The primary benefits are that these funds will continue to be available to the individual for their supplemental needs for a longer period of time because we will avoid some of the ongoing administrative costs imposed by a conservatorship on the individual so that their funds will be able to be used for them for a longer period of time. It will free up a little bit of space, at least on the court dockets, so they won't have to be reviewing annual accountings. dealing with issues of bonding the conservator every year and those types of issues that regularly come up in a conservatorship. And again, the primary benefit to the individual would be that we eliminate the administrative burden to them of having to pay for not only a trustee, but also pay for the ongoing conservatorship expenses as well. There are some limitations we included in our request for this bill, that the amounts in question would be $50,000 or less. So if the individual has a conservatorship and the amount in the conservatorship is more than $50,000 and it's going to be placed in a special needs trust, those would not be subject to this bill. Those would stay under the court's purview. That's a significant enough amount of money that we want the court to regularly review those accountings each year. So these would be limited to the circumstances where there's less than $50,000. The money has been placed into a supplemental needs trust, and there is good cause shown to the court to go ahead and close the conservatorship and then allow the trust to, or the trustee to continue to manage those funds for the individual.
Okay.
Other questions?
Senator Cruz, did you have a question? I don't work in the social service area much, but it's my understanding that if someone has needs-based programs and they pass away, that the state can recover from their estate some of the cost. Would this influence that in any way?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The trust, the supplemental needs trust that is involved would be a payback trust. If that individual's funds are going into this type of a trust, by its nature, that trust has to be available for estate recovery to collect on after that individual passes away. So there is also the potential that in reducing the administrative expenses to the trust, to the individuals, to the money, that there is at least a slightly larger amount available for the estate recovery department to recover after the individual passes away.
Okay, and if this bill didn't pass, is there money in the conservatorship protected from recovery by the state if the person passed away?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the assumption is that the money would go into this trust anyway in order to allow this individual to remain on their public benefit programs. If we have an individual who receives a $40,000 lump sum back payment from Social Security, which really is not all that uncommon, because sometimes it may take 5 years or longer for Social Security to accurately determine their benefit, they get a lump sum payment, it knocks them off of their SSI and off of their Medicaid, and they're facing a situation where they've maybe got $40,000 and no income coming in and no medical coverage, and all that money would be used up very quickly. By creating this conservatorship to put those funds into a trust, you're allowing the individual to remain on SSI and receive their Medicaid benefits, and that all happens as it is now. The problem that we're trying to address here is that the statute requires that the conservatorship remain open. Even though that money is in a trust and is managed by a trustee, the conservatorship has to remain open, and so we have the regular accountings by the conservator to the court. We have bonding issues with the court. We have those administrative expenses that reduce the amount that's available to the individual, the beneficiary.
Okay, so why was it set up like that way in the first place? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, ORS 125.440 sub 2, that provision was included when ORS 125 was put together in order to keep a mass wave of trusts from being created by the court just for the purpose of eliminating conservatorships. It's not at all uncommon for a trust or a court to create a trust for an individual, but the goal was to keep those funds in general under the purview of the court. If an individual If a court creates a trust for an individual and then the trustee wants to avoid court oversight, well, then they could simply ask the court to terminate the conservatorship and then continue to manage it as trustee without court supervision. ORS 125.440 was drafted the way it is in order to avoid that circumstance. House Bill 2360 was limited in scope only to the situations where there's less than $50,000 and that money is put into a supplemental needs trust in order to help protect the finances of those very limited few people, but not to open it up completely to allow a huge wave of these cases to be swept out from underneath the court's purview.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. We have nobody else signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to talk on this? Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2360. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2360. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2360 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2360 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, would you like to carry it?
Sure.
Or you want to carry it?
I don't
you
want
carry
to carry it.
Referee,
but you want me to.
Okay, I'll let you two fight over it.
I got it.
Okay. Senator Beyer will carry this. Okay, now we have Ms. Plummer here for our last bill here. Mr. Crane's in the audience here. There he is. Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 553. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 553 is at the request of the Governor for the Criminal Justice Commission. The bill approves adoption of amendments to sentencing guidelines in the Oregon Administrative Rules by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission as a result of the 2005 legislative session.
Okay. Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Prinz for the record. This is the Criminal Justice Commission amendments that are in light of the 2005 criminal law changes. It's usually one of the most boring bills you have, and I hope it stays that way because there's really nothing. What we do, if you all know this, but we just take the new or amended crimes and we rank new crimes on the crime seriousness level on the grid. So. To do that required us to amend, there's actually 13 rules in the bill that were amended. This is probably the easiest way for us to go through them to see if you want me to be specific about any of them. There's the, I wrote down what each rule change did. And so if you'd like, I could tell you where we ranked crimes that went through. Basically, there were very few felony crimes that were passed last session. Unlawful contact with a child, custodial sexual misconduct in the first degree, and maintaining a dangerous dog were three felonies that we ranked as person crimes with crime seriousnesses of seven, and I believe... five for a dangerous dog. Incidentally, maintaining a dangerous dog is a felony only if the dog kills someone. So that's why it was that level of crime. I didn't want it, people to think that it was just a dog that was barking or biting or something. And then we set we classified certain crimes that were passed last session as person class A misdemeanors. And that would have been custodial misconduct in the second degree. That's the from Senate Bill 89. That's the, if you recall, that has to do with inappropriate sexual relationships between a correctional officer and an inmate. And so that was the lesser. The second degree was a person misdemeanor. Unlawfully being in a location where children regularly congregate. House Bill 3469, that was ranked as a person class A misdemeanor. That's if a predatory sex offender was, like, for example, hanging around at a public school. That's a misdemeanor that we ranked as a person misdemeanor. So those are the crimes that we ranked. And there's a couple more that I could go through if you want me to. I never know, frankly, how much is too much information. So I'm going to stop there and see if you have any questions. And I'll remind you that the way this works in statute is we set these new seriousness levels and person or non-person categories. They become effective law, but the subsequent legislature, you all in the 2007 legislature, must, if you do not ratify those, they sunset on January 1, 2008. So that's why we bring those to you. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to go through any other ones you have questions on.
On the custodial sexual misconduct,
yes,
the first or second degree.
Yes.
To your knowledge, has that been invoked? I know there have been several cases in the notes.
Madam Chair, it has been already used. Unfortunately, I believe a correctional officer is serving time at Coffee Creek, and she was convicted of sexual misconduct in the first degree.
Okay. Since we passed the new
Correct.
Law, obviously. Okay, well, it's nice to know what we're doing works.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. A couple questions.
Yep.
The mess package, we told you where to put some things. I assume those aren't in this then?
Actually, Senator Beyer, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, they are in here, and I'll show you the ones that you told me. The first one is on our list here, Senator. One of the things in the meth package was in Senate Bill 907. That's the Senate side of the meth package. We amended child neglect in the first degree where there was methamphetamine involved, and the legislature told us to do it as crime category 6, so I made that. We made that amendment. And then there was also disposing of meth waste, and let me find that one for you, Senator. And then the bigger thing I had to do on the meth is I conformed the, when we broke out all the crimes, I conformed it so that it kept everything the way it had been. So no matter what, you know, now that we have the crime of possession of heroin, possession of cocaine, possession of meth, those are all the same crime seriousness they were. So I did that as well.
Before you leave that topic, there was a mistake made in the legislation itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that may have been the direction of your question.
Is that the one you were...
Well, go ahead. No.
There was a mistake made in meth.
Yeah, it dealt with marijuana, though.
Yeah, marijuana. So is the mistake incorporated in these rules?
Madam Chair, to answer that, what I did is when I looked at the rules for the first time, the statute actually lays out in statute what the crime category is for every drug crime. So instead of having it try to be duplicative in the rules, what you can see is I just said I'm incorporating the statute by reference. The statute's going to trump the rule anyways. And so I think I've fixed that problem, that even though there was the error regarding the marijuana, when we fix that statute, the rules will be in lockstep with it. Does that follow?
Well, so what happens between now and when this, because I believe we've already passed the bill through this committee anyway to fix the problem.
Yeah.
But what happens between now and when that bill goes into effect in terms of prosecuting these kinds of offenses?
Madam Chair, when I've talked to prosecutors and defense attorneys, they've always known the intent. So we were we were making sure that there was really no argument. And so everyone's been treating those things as a seriousness level 4, which was what we always wanted it to be. So I think we're just making it crystal clear that that's what the intent was.
But in these rules, is it a 4 or a 6?
It's a 4.
Okay.
I'll show you, where are we? If you look at the rule change, and I gave you the rule change with bold print to show the new language, if you look at crime category 4, which is delivery or manufacture of a controlled substance. That was the one on marijuana that when we redid that, we made a mistake on it. And so you see where it just says delivery or manufacture of a controlled substance. ORS 475.903A is incorporated herein by reference. That will capture that marijuana issue. And what happened with the mistake was we had a catch-all that basically captured marijuana delivery as a level 4, and this will continue to treat it that way. So I think we're finding a crime category
4 in my...
If you look in your rule packet, it's on the... way in the back, and it says crime category 4 on the top.
There it is. Okay, got it.
So I'm confident that we got that fixed correctly, and but obviously if you'd like me to go through it with counsel after, I can certainly do that to make sure we got it correct.
Okay, yeah, because it's one of those odd things. We all knew what we meant. And
I know.
And yet I'm not sure you had the statutory authority because of the mistake to put it in the rules this way.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, on your question regarding the other one that I classified, I don't believe the legislature directed was possession or disposal of methamphetamine waste. And we classified that as crime category 4. And by my recollection, those were the two felonies within the meth package that that we needed to address. This might be also that you all passed the repeat delivery part of the meth package. That's in statute. So we didn't need to do anything with the rule. In statute, it says what the presumptive sentence is. So I think that took care of itself.
Okay. Now to a completely different issue, if it's okay, I'm
please
sure.
Follow up.
You're under maintain a dangerous dog, serious physical injury.
I knew we'd have
you
to talk
about dog kills person.
Yeah.
I hope this means dog seriously physical injury of a person, not another dog.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It's it's an interesting crime. It did not go through Judiciary Committee last session. What has to happen to have someone be convicted of maintaining a dangerous dog as a felony? Would the dog first would have to be brought? You'd have to bring the case before a court and have the dog. A judge would have to say this is a dangerous dog. And then subsequent to that, the dog would have to kill a person. That would be committing the felony of maintaining a dangerous dog.
You said this didn't come through judiciary. Did this go through rules?
I can't remember, Madam Chair.
But we did that.
I think that
was in judiciary last session, unless a different bill.
I'll bet you. I mean, we can look at it. I'll check. From the way it's written, I don't think it came through Judiciary Committee.
That was very tactfully put. If it did, I guess we better reevaluate our...
And I wouldn't say that unless I was pretty confident it didn't. But now I better check.
No comment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Thank you. Anything else you wanted to add, Craig?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on this bill, Senate Bill 553, and I think we're going to hold on to it a while. This is the first we've seen of this, and I want Senator Beyer in particular to have a chance to go through with his eagle eye on some of these things. Such a gift for this, Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I thought we just did.
Well, if you'd like to move this, I'm
ready to move it.
Okay, I think we'll do that then. Okay, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 553, and Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 553 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 553 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, I will carry this bill. Okay, any other business before the committee? Seeing none, Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you.
Have your daughter.